This is Ed Mazur, chairman of the City Club of Chicago. Our topic today was the future of digital media, an ever-changing area of discussion. Our panelists included Bruce Stold of the Chicago Tribune, Edwin Eisendrath of the Chicago Sun-Times, Morgan Johnson of an internet online called Tribe, Seamus Toomey, most recently of DNA Info and now starting Block Chicago. The panel was moderated by Ellen Alberding, who's the president of the Joyce Foundation. All the panelists agreed that an independent media is a very important role to be played in any kind of democratic government. Bruce Stold said the Trib will be the most complete source for what people need to do. He hopes to be not only a conversation starter, but help people get through the day and plan for the future. Edwin Eisendrath of the Sun-Times said the same. But we said the backbone of our readership are the working men and women of Chicago. Morgan Johnson's TRIIBE, an electronic media source, is only digital and is an attempt to give folks 30s or younger, particularly the African-American community, a narrative in the city of Chicago. Seamus Toomey of Block Chicago said no story is too small to be covered, and he says that his reporters will be on the street and in the neighborhood. All of the panelists shared several things in common. They talked about the need for a sensitive ownership, a diverse management team, building trust with the leadership and readership. Finally, what do we do with the demographics of the future? There are more and more of the younger millennial crowd that will not pay, so they go onto the internet. So the question came up about paywalls, and all the respondents said there is no free ride. Journalists have a right to be paid for their efforts, so that seeing a no paywall or free is not likely to happen. The Tribune Online subscription has increased dramatically in the last year. Bruce Stold said that in March, there were 18 million unique visitors to the Tribune. Currently, they have 75,000 digital-only subscribers. The Sun-Times shared similar numbers with the audience. The final questions dealt with the question of the public does not seem to trust the media. What can we do? All the panelists agreed that the media must be transparent in their product that they produce, that this is a great time to build trust with people, given what's going on in Washington, D.C., and that people want facts, and they know that through the media, whether it be print or electronic, they will get the facts.
We have a ton of ground to cover, but I wanted to just explain a little bit why actually I'm up here, which is that the Joyce Foundation has a deep and longstanding commitment to supporting media, independent media, and you've heard us on National Public Radio and WBEZ. We're very proud sponsors of ProPublica, which is another nonprofit media startup here that, in partnership with the Tribune, after only 6 months, was a Pulitzer finalist, which is really pretty amazing. But last year, we did a little bit of reorganization in our foundation, and we thought about, like, why are we funding media? How does it fit into our portfolio? What are we trying to accomplish? And we realized that the reason we think an independent media is so important is because of the role it plays in our democracy. It is just critically important to holding together the folks in our country. And all of us know what's going on in the media now, both in politics and in other ways. So we decided to fold all of our media grant making into our democracy portfolio. So we expanded the portfolio to include all of our media grant making. And Carrie Davis, if you want to raise your hand, is the wonderful person leading that portfolio and learning. She's a transplant from Columbus, Ohio, so she's really learning the scene here. But she's your person if you want to talk about media vis-a-vis the Joyce Foundation. So thanks, Carrie, in advance for all the great work you're going to do funding the media. So what's the question we're trying to address here? A lot of people have been talking about the demise of the media, in part because of technology. and the disruptions that technology are causing or may be causing, and other people are talking about whether actually traditional print media can survive. You know, will there be a Chicago Tribune? Will there be a Chicago Sun-Times? What would our city be like if we didn't have, you know, a gray lady or the hardest working newspaper and show business? Is that the is that how you're selling yourself?
I can see why you put me all the way on the end.
I mean, seriously, like it's for someone in my generation, it's almost unimaginable not to have a print newspaper. And yet, I read almost everything online now. You know, it's just it's an unusual situation that we're in, and I don't think any of us know the answers. But I thought we could open by asking each of you to briefly describe why you think what you do is important to our democracy, and then we'll get, I've got some specific questions for each of you to answer after that. And I think for those of you who are new, if you could just explain who you are a little bit might be useful as well. So, Bruce, do you want to open?
Sure. Actually, I want to show you something first. This is the perspective front of Chicago Tribune, August 23rd, 1987. The first time that I quoted a freshman alderman named Edwin Eisinger.
Oh.
We're not supposed to reveal our sources, but I got to tell you, he was a pretty good source.
Ooh.
He was smart. He was a freshman. You know, he had his eyes open, and he was honest. And he was in the Chicago City Council. So
that pretty much
we
did
do
him
go,
in,
we do go way back. So how do we frame ourselves? The Chicago Tribune is going to be the place that you can go every day and get the full run of the information that you need to lead your daily lives. It's going to be the most complete product in the market here by far. We're going to be the organization that stands up to government secrecy, that stands up to government power. We'll be that check on government that is the reason that we were put in the Constitution in the first place. We'll talk a little bit about Joe Berrios and the need to check power in a couple of minutes. You talk about democracy. We're going to be the place when Lin-Manuel Miranda wants to tell you about his new exhibit in Chicago, that where he's going to go. And so we spent Sunday afternoon with Lin-Manuel Miranda and the producers of the new exhibit. Why?
If we funded you, would you invite me to go along?
Your deal. Why? I think he wanted to meet with the editorial board. He wanted to meet with Chris Jones because we've got a world-class theater critic like no one else in the city right now. Thank you. And because we have an editorial board with impact. So he sought us out, and we were able to get an exclusive to you today. So in a nutshell, I think that gives a sense. We're going to make your conversation starters. We're going to represent you before government, and we're going to give you all the information that you need to go to get through the day.
All right. Morgan, you've got a hyper-focused mission. Tell us a little bit about why you decided to form Tribe. Why are there two eyes, and where do you see the organization going?
Okay, The Tribe is a digital publication that was founded by myself and Tiffany Walden because we saw that there was a need to reshape the narrative of Black Chicago specifically. No one was speaking directly for us or to us, and we noticed that when we pitched our stories to legacy media companies, they often did not even understand what we were talking about. So we knew that we could do this and that we wouldn't have any competition. We looked at how Black Chicago was represented in around the world, really. You could go anywhere and say, hey, I'm from Chicago, and they say, the war zone? How did you make it out? And when we think about all the contributions that Black people of Chicago have made to this world, it's pretty sad that all of that has been diminished to gun violence. And it's not just about our contributions to the world, it's about covering people with the type of wholeness and humanity that we just don't see reflected in the news. So that's what we created, and that's what we represent.
So the Columbia Journalism Review did a profile of the Tribe and talked, the headline really was about how different perspectives in big cities are just not being covered at all, and that is really exactly what Morgan just talked about and why her efforts, I think, really have legs and are really important, actually for all of us to be reading.
Right, and it's The Tribe with Two Eyes, just because we had no money when we were funded, and the domain was $2, and we bought it.
Thought it was some really cool thing that I didn't get, so you know. Okay, Seamus.
I've also been looking for domains, and I totally know what you're talking about. That is hard. You know, at DNA Info Chicago, we always had a saying that there's no story too small. And by that we meant if it only mattered to a certain neighborhood, that's fine. Let's just send it out just to that neighborhood. If the people in Rogers Park don't care about it, that's fine. The people in Beverly were interested in it. And that was really what we were going for, because I think people want to be active in their communities. They want to be active in democracy, but sometimes they don't know where to start. And we want to show them where to start. We're the ones going to the community meetings, to the local school council meetings, to the development meetings, to the CAPS meetings. You know, we're there and we're keeping an eye on everything and we're reporting back, even if it's a tiny story, you know, even if it's something that is not incredibly important citywide, it is for that neighborhood. And that's really how we're trying to distinguish ourselves, to add to the democracy of it. We're there. We have people on the ground. They're living in the neighborhoods. They're talking to real people. They're not sitting in a downtown desk trying to figure out, you know, what's the news here and the desk around me. They're out working. One of our reporters, she works in the furniture shop on Milwaukee Avenue in Wicker Park. She like leases out like the fourth couch from the back, and she's there and she knows everything that's going on in the neighborhood. So, you know, that's really what we're going for, is to be the eyes and ears of each individual neighborhood and send it out directly to those folks.
Great. Edwin.
So, Ellen, it doesn't surprise me, but I'm enormously grateful that you're asking this question. It's the most important question, more important than the digital strategy, more important than the funding mechanisms. How we play in this democracy, our terribly frayed democracy, is the core of what we should talk about. So I'm grateful to you for that. Let me talk about four things quickly. Ownership is one. If you look at what Alden Capital is doing to newspapers in Denver and around the country, you'll see that the wrong kind of ownership can be more destructive than any digital trends to journalism. The Sun-Times has certainly been through some of that. The team that came together to rescue the Sun-Times, I think I said that when I was here last time, is enormously diverse in its economic base. So wealthy individuals and organized labor came together to save the Sun-Times. And I think, and that Bob Reiter, who's sitting here, may have given me this line, if you walk in any building downtown, the building's likely built, maintained, and cleaned by the hands of the people who own the Sun-Times. I think that's pretty terrific. And it gets it makes you think differently. It gives you a different relationship with the communities that you serve. And it gives us, in our case, an editorial mission, which is to have the backs of the working women and men of Chicago. And if we do that, we think we shrink this partisan lens a little bit, so we can just be genuine with people and recreate a shared base of facts, which we all need in order to do our job, whether it's setting policy or granting funds to organizations. So ownership matters, and I think we've done pretty well there. On diversity, the biggest shock for me when I walked into the Sun-Times was that there were no women in positions of authority and very few people of color anywhere. We've made a concerted effort not to diversify, but to find the best talent in Chicago. And in so doing, we are a much more diverse place, with women and people of color in positions of authority, not just in the business side, but in the newsroom as well. And that leads to different kind of storytelling, also important for the democracy. So impact, Bruce talked a lot about this, and he has a bigger staff, and he will have a lot of impact. But we do, too, and we believe in that kind of journalism. Lauren Fitzpatrick's work just a couple weeks ago led to the hiring of 100 new janitors in schools. makes a huge difference for kids and everybody. That's really great reporting, and it's the kind of reporting that is hard to do and expensive to do. But we're doing something different. And if you all have your phones, please go to 31bullets.suntimes.com, because we have launched a campaign against gun violence that is nothing like news organizations have done before. It's an integrated campaign that is editorial and video, and it's journalism, but it's also community building and events. And we have already seen early on that the artifacts that we've created are being shared widely across the internet, not just in Chicago, but around the country, to give people not just the information, but the tool sets they need to make a difference on something that I know matters greatly to us here in Chicago and around the country. The last thing is trust, and I think all these things go to trust and building this. I just want to remind everybody that the Sun-Times current readership, paper readership, is about 30% African American, 30% people who describe themselves as white ethnic working class. We have Trump voters, we have anti-Trump voters, if that's what they are, you know, and they still trust one place to tell them their stories. That is a great place to build back the fabric of our democracy and the trust we need.
Thank you. So everything I understand, and I know there are people in the room who know this way better than I do. My friend David Hiller came out of the business. Stephanie Banchero is here now on the Joyce team. But it sounds like a terrible business. I mean, I got this number from Jim Warren, a former Tribune reporter. He told me that 7 years ago there were 32 full-time reporters in Springfield, and now there are three. Wow. And, you know, I know you've had layoffs. It's just a tough, tough time. And in general, it seems like the digital interventions have not played in your favor. And it seems like the New York Times and the Washington Post are the two newspapers in the country that actually are growing their digital revenue to the point where it's actually supporting their bottom line. You may know more than that. But on the other hand, it seems like digital interventions can be a positive. And I think, you know, Morgan, your operation would be an example of how having a different kind of access to news could be a positive overall. So I just want to get two perspectives, Morgan and Bruce, if you could just talk about sort of the pluses and minuses of these changes that we're going through right now in the whole news industry.
I don't know that I can speak to the change because we never were.
Well, you wouldn't exist probably.
Right, we wouldn't exist without it, and that's the only kind of journalism that we really know. I mean, I'm 28 years old, so. But I can tell you that.
I won't take umbrage at that.
So can you ask the question again? Like,
well, so the question is, many people think of new media, digital interventions as being a negative, an overall negative for the media industry. But there are also positives. And I guess I'm holding you out as an example of like why it can be good, because you get more voices, it's less expensive to produce and to receive, potentially.
Right. Two people can come together and create a publication with $2, and we can have a massive impact. I mean, that's the plus. And there's no barrier between us and our consumers, you know, which we're trying to reach Black youth, Black Chicago millennials. And we know that they can reach us on their phones. And that's, you know, when you care about community outreach and you care about impact, that's the most important thing. That's the plus to that.
And Bruce, how's your online subscription numbers going? You probably don't want to talk about them specifically.
No, I'll talk about it.
Yeah.
First, I'm going to say we're staffed in Springfield. And Monique Garcia, who's there, does a great job for us. And I understand that that is a far different thing. When I covered Springfield and the place was crawling with journalists. So it's even more important for Monique
so
to be there.
Yeah, we love what she does.
So I'd say I think it's a great business. I'm having a great time in it. We got, according to ComScore, we have 18 million unique visitors in March. Colonel McCormick could only dream about that kind of an audience. I mean, you and you can put it. You can put the Sun-Times, and you can put WGN, and you can put the Daily Herald, and CBS, and NBC, and they all. You put them all together, and they just about match us. So we do have a significant audience advantage there, and it's growing. We're also building on. We're retaining. We're keeping. We're in getting people to invest more in us. We've got about. We've passed 75,000 digital-only subscribers. They're not print folks anymore. They've made that conversion with us. We know what they're reading. We know that they're reading really substantive material that we are, that we're putting out. That's grown by about 75% just in the last year. So, no, the national, it's not competitive with the national publications and the numbers they have, but it is something, it is a key to what we're going to do, to what we have to do, to understand that audience as well, and to make more conversions. At the same time, our Sunday print paid circulation is third or fourth still in the country. It depends on where the Washington Post is. We're neck and neck. That's a big audience still. Tens of thousands of those folks have also signed up for digital. They may become digital subscribers only for us at some point. They may not. They may stick with a print and digital hybrid. But again, we see they are our most invested readers, and we can learn more about them. One of the keys going forward for us is going to be understanding, better understanding that audience, and in real time responding to it, so that if you are a digital subscriber, we are giving you what you need so you come back again and again and again. There's one other point I'd like to make on the opportunity here. When you look at the work that we did on the property tax assessment system, there's work. First of all, you needed someone like the Tribune that would make the commitment. We worked for 18 months on that before there was a word in the paper, partly because it is extraordinarily complex work, and partly because the assessor's office put up every blockade and continues today to put up blockades. There's an appellate court hearing on a FOIA that they're still after us on that. But what we could do with that, we could make the commitment. We could show people exactly how you have a property tax system that is rigged against poorest homeowners and commercial property owners, and then you could give them the data to prove it. So if we have a trust issue, Joe Berrios certainly didn't think we were trustworthy on that, but we could put the data out. It was a partnership with the University of Chicago, which worked with us to make sure that the data was bulletproof. You can go to our website now, you can see it right now. And then that project continued in partnership with ProPublica Illinois, and as you mentioned, it was a Pulitzer Prize finalist in local reporting this year. It's a good example of where having the reach that you can have and providing the vast information that you can provide to build trust really works for us in a way that print never could.
We're going to move to questions in a little while, but I already had a question from the audience that relates to what you were just saying. The question was, are paywalls going away? Please say yes. I'm guessing the answer is no, but, you know.
If you subscribe, you don't see the paywall.
There you go.
Hey, Ellen. Yeah. I want to, whoever asked that question, why should journalists work for free? Why? Really? Seriously? And why?
Yeah, okay.
And the work is very hard, and they work for months and months on these projects, and some of them require enormous resources. Certainly Bruce talked about that, some of the work we've done for schools. Really takes lots of people, lots of time. They get real training for this, they work really, really hard, and there's no other field that you can name where you ask people to give everything they do away for free.
So one of the, this might be a little bit of a self-serving question, but one of the things I'm wondering about is the role of philanthropy in the media landscape. So I have spoken with each of you about philanthropic support of one kind or another for your organizations, but I think there are pros and cons to that. And Seamus, you just recently went through the process of deciding whether to be for-profit or not-for-profit. I'd love to hear from you on why you chose not-for-profit, and Bruce, maybe a little bit of an exploration of, you know, some of the negatives that there might be associated with a philanthropic partner on a project.
Sure. This was a decision we made. We spent a lot of time on. We changed our mind about a dozen times in a couple weeks, going back and forth, pros and cons. Ultimately, what it came down to is that we wanted to position ourselves in doing the public service for the neighborhoods. And to best do that, we thought we could do it better as a nonprofit, where we're not trying to do this to make a buck. We're trying to do this to serve the neighborhoods and to put every dollar that we make back to the reporters that are doing the job. To the point of smaller, you know, we can, you know, as a just digital only, we can put all that money, you know, we're not paying trucks, we're not getting newsprint, we're paying the reporters directly to go out and find the news. So that's pretty much why we wanted to be a nonprofit, was to make this clear to everyone that we are in it for them, and that we can go out to the philanthropic world as well and just talk about ideas that we can better serve neighborhoods around Chicago. That's really what it came down to. There was also an issue of scaling. The more we looked at the for-profit model, the more it ultimately got down to, that'll be great, and next thing we'll know, we'll cover LA, and then we'll cover St. Louis. And then we said, whoa, slow down. We want to cover Chicago. We want to cover all parts of Chicago. And rather than talking about branching out into somewhere else and diluting our hyper-local coverage, which is the only way to do it without hiring thousands of reporters, we got to keep it small, we got to keep it focused. And to do that, we didn't want to scale it outside of the borders of Chicago. So that's why we went nonprofit.
So, Bruce, you know, in the field there's a debate about philanthropy, you know, what sort of influence we might have if we were sponsoring a series on, like if it was Joyce Foundation on gun violence, for example. Would our point of view be overly represented, you know, or can there be a firewall?
As we found out when we did a project together with the with the editorial board.
Yes.
First, I'm going to say, Justin, Tim, we are for profit. It's a good thing. we have talked about how we could do partnerships, and I know there are some obstacles to them. I think the New York Times set up a unit to explore this. The Guardian set up its own not-for-profit to see how they could do it. I think there are ways to do it. Most of the issues seem to be, I think, in the not-for-profit world on how we might corrupt you. I'm glad to partner with you. One way we have talked through is whether we do it as a legal offense fund. It is expensive to do the kind of work that we did with the property tax system. There are legal fees involved. There are a number of organizations, smaller organizations, that just don't have the wherewithal to do that. If there's a way to set up a fund that organizations could tap into so they could bring those kind of cases, you know, maybe that would be one way to do it. I think we are, well, I don't want to reveal anything. We're talking with other not-for-profits that are coming into town that I think there's room to have good partnerships with. I was talking to the editor of the Denver Post last week about how they work with Chalkbeat, which is coming into Chicago. So that was an interesting.
We're big supporters of Chalkbeat. Yeah, that's a great organization that Stephanie has linked us up with. Yeah, Morgan.
I just want to add that the tribe, we're also deciding whether we're currently for profit and we're thinking of becoming, or at least having, a nonprofit leg, because since my background is filmmaking, we're thinking of having a part of the tribe be more of a production company, and so that we're not only looking for our .com to fund all of our operations. So we think that the future of media is going to be more of a hybrid model of multiple different things, which is why we do events and, you know, merchandise, and we see ourselves as more of a brand that people can identify with. And my questions about the paywall, I mean, the reason why we don't do it is because it obviously going to create a barrier between us and our audience. We know millennials are not going to pay for it. So, I mean, my questions for you all is that, are millennials reading, you know, your publications? And if they're not, like, what do you see is going to happen in the future if the paywalls continue?
Well, Morgan is now taking over the panel.
Yeah.
Sorry. I think that's a really great question.
Morgan, if millennials are reading, and they're reading online for us at remarkable rates, actually, and the 31 Bullets campaign has already attracted lots of millennials. But your generation, like every generation before, it's going to step up and pay for the things that support financially the things that make the democracy work. There are no free rides in a democracy. Everybody's got to do something. I don't think for-profit, non-profit matters very much. Tax status doesn't matter. You can raise funds a little more easily in a for-profit structure if you can show you're profitable. But, you know, maybe the issue became really important in the last 10 years because not all of the owners in the for-profit world were good stewards of this enormously important function in our democracy. We've seen, again, just look at Denver. We've seen a lot of examples of that.
Bruce, how is your millennial audience? Is it where you want it to be?
There's a big difference between digital and print, no question about it, but we know so much more about the digital audience. So Lollapalooza, when the lineup comes out, there's a great feed. The Hamilton scoop that we had today, I could see when people were reading, more than half of that was coming through Facebook traffic. So that was a big story that was being shared. So there's no question. We have to get them into the idea of paying for content. They grew up in a different model than you and I did. And I think once we can build that habit with them and find a good price point for them, we'll bring them in.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested in this idea of video because several people have suggested to me that video, online video, is a way to connect with and hook in younger readers, /watchers. So I don't know if that's why you're doing it or if it's more...
I'm just saying millennials decided that we weren't going to pay for music anymore and now we have streaming sites and it like changed the whole model. And I think that if journalism doesn't get ahead of that and other sites are offering free content, that is going to be a problem.
Mm-hmm. And just to talk about millennials and DNA Info and Block Club, I mean, there are tons of millennials that only got their information from DNA Info. I mean, go ask one where they hear about the bar closing or about the what happened down the street or what that development is. You know, we've had nothing but people come out of the woodwork since we closed to talk about, you guys were the only ones we got our information from, and we are going to be willing to pay for it because we didn't pay for it before and it went away. And I think, you know, millennials pay for things on a monthly basis all the time. And I think once they realize that there's value from the news that they're getting, they're going to pay for that as well.
Well, sounds like we have a little bit of a disagreement here.
From the millennial.
So on that point, just to push it one more time, Edwin, you put up a cover last week or 2 weeks ago that was blank.
Yep.
And it was a little bit of a stunt, but you were basically making a play for or a plea for support for journalism, specifically the Sun-Times. What was the reaction, and did it pay off for you?
So Bruce has 70,000 digital subscribers, we just heard, and before that I had none, right? So, and he's talked about its role in funding the organization. It is essential to do it to save the Sun-Times. Without it, we will not survive. What I learned was something I learned last July when we put the group together to rescue the Sun-Times. I learned that people love the Sun-Times. The outpouring, just from that blank cover, was awesome. Not just in terms of subscriptions that day, which really knocked my socks off, but the phone calls and the support. And you know what? The journalists who said, "Can I write something about and to tell everybody to subscribe?" And man, it didn't come from management. That came from the journalists. People love the Sun-Times. And that's what I found when we did that. I wish it was a joke. You know, we have a hole to dig out of, and we are digging. You can all help. Bruce, you can help.
I'm a subscriber.
Yes. Do you hear that? You guys all have permission now to subscribe and tell your friends. It's easy. And we're less expensive. So for those millennials.
Are you a subscriber?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So,
I think we all need to subscribe to everything up here.
Yeah. Right? It's just, so that's what I learned. I learned it was heartwarming. Look, you ask if it's a terrible business. I love this for 20 hours a day. Love it. 4 hours at night, I shiver under covers going like, are we going to be okay? Are we going to be okay? Because it's a hole we're digging out of. But it's a fabulous thing to do for the reasons that were clear in your very first question. We have to get this right to have the country we want. It's pretty simple.
Yeah. Okay, we have time for questions, and I don't know if you want to... Are we doing them in writing? How are we doing the questions? You'll hand them to me. Okay,
yeah,
great.
If anyone has a question, if you would just jot it down. And
What do you really want to know from these folks? I see a couple in the back. I have one very specific question from Chester Kropodolowski with the Lakeview Citizens Council. And his question actually is for you, Seamus. He used to really appreciate DNA Info's coverage in Lakeview. And how does he get your reporters to come to their community meetings? And with the understanding you haven't launched yet.
But sure, sure.
So how do people get your reporters to cover their stuff?
That's actually one of the great things about Block Club is that our reporters are around. You can text them, you can call them direct, you can email them, you can send it to me, and then I will forward it on to them. I mean, we are some of the most available reporters around there. Our reporters, you know, apologize to us for when they can't go to four different meetings in one night. So, yeah, the best way is to, you can email me at newsroom@blockclubshy.org, or you can, you know, once we're up and running, our email addresses and phone numbers will be all over the place to get a hold of us, and we'll show up.
Great. A really great question from John Schatz with the Jewish United Fund. He's asking, how do you balance the economic necessity of paywalls with the ghettoization of like minds that result from readers deciding which media they will pay for? And sort of a related question is sort of the atomization of people's interactions based on, you know, just very, very only talking to people they agree with. Mm-hmm. It seems like a problem for mm-hmm. all of us, but I don't know, Bruce, you want to get into that?
I wind up in a lot of conversations with readers who don't like the balance of columnists in the paper. They made some of them, yep, there's John. If they don't like John Cass, they tell them to read Darlene Glanton. If they don't like Darlene, they tell them to read John. I think that within those conversations, you're trying to break down exactly that kind of wall. They if they only want to read what they agree with, they're just not getting what we can provide to them.
So, Morgan, how would you answer that? Because you are very focused on a particular set of folks.
Again, so the paywall thing is not an issue.
No,
so.
Yes, skip the paywall question,
right.
But the, you know, just talking to ourselves.
Well, we have a community forum on the first Tuesday of every month. We call it Tribe Tuesdays, where our audience can directly address us, come to us with questions, ideas, pitches. We take an issue from a story that we've covered most recently. Tiffany wrote a great story about the West Side. It's going to be a series exploring the divestment in the West Side and what we can do to revitalize the community. So we brought together a panel of experts in real estate and community organizers to talk to our audience about how we can be more involved in revitalizing the community. So the fact that we have a forum built in already where people know that they can come and talk to us and address us, I think really helps us engage and make our tribe a community.
Okay.
Thank you.
I wish people had little typewriters. Okay, this is a question from Joe Moore, our wonderful alderman from the 49th Ward. Bruce, please comment on the upcoming acquisition of the Tribune by Sinclair. Can the Trib remain independent editorially?
I am so glad to get that question.
Yeah.
There is no connection at all. What's being talked about there is Tribune Media, which Sinclair is taking on. That's broadcast. It has nothing to do with the Chicago Tribune or the newspaper properties or their website.
Okay.
Okay.
How about I amend it and say independence of broadcast journalism?
Now I'm not sure what you mean.
Well,
as long as I'm outing Alderman, Joe was a good source too. What do you mean?
Well, there were concerns expressed a few weeks ago when all of the anchormen from the local affiliates were told by Sinclair's leadership to read this supposed statement of edit, you know, of fairness and covering the news, and they were all the same, you know, the same statement read over and over again, and created quite a stir. And I'm wondering about the influence of the large conglomerates as they gobble up media, whether it's broadcast or print, whether local news editors can retain their editorial independence.
So we understand this isn't your exact problem, but it's something that's...
Right, but I think it speaks...
Summarize the question.
Sinclair required each of its outlets to read the same message, a political message, essentially. If you see the reel on it, take snippets from each one of them, and it's really, it's a Stepford Wives kind of thing. It's really pretty staggering. I can guarantee you if I told John Cass what to write, he'd punch me. That's the essence of editorial independence. We're not going to do that. We're going to value. We value that.
And if that happened in a neighborhood, we would cover that.
And we're so eager, we'd sell tickets.
Stuart Brainerd has an interesting question that I hadn't really thought of or thought about, but is there any move toward crowd-funded journalism that allows for the aggregation and curation of individual voices and point of view? Think ways for journalism. And maybe that's a little bit of what you're talking about with your Tuesday forums. I don't know. But
well, we just had a crowdfunding campaign.
No, but crowdfunding voices,
crowdfunding,
not money.
Voices.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So the tribe
crowdsourcing.
The tribe has four kind of tenets of our site, and one part of it is called The People, where we give everyday Black folks a voice in their story. Because the whole thing about the tribe is giving the people ownership of what Black Chicago's narrative really is. So you can go to the people, you can pitch an op-ed to us, because this idea that only one columnist or one expert can write for the same paper for 20 years, we feel like that's outdated, and we want to get...
Sorry, John.
So yeah, we want to give the community a voice in their story, and you can, I mean, we help refine it and curate it, but there is an opportunity for anyone to write for us.
Edwin, you want to jump in here? You seem to have
No, I was
opinions.
Your sorry John comment made me laugh.
Yeah. All right. Okay. How does the tribe get its revenue? It's a question from Tom Bookie.
Oh yeah, we're still trying. So on the one hand, like I said, I'm a filmmaker, so we will do work for hire jobs. But we don't really see other media platforms as competition. We're happy to do a series with the Chicago Reader, which mm-hmm. we do have. It's called The Block Beat. And it's a music series where we take different artists to neighborhoods, and we learn about what about that neighborhood grounds them in their craft. So this is a series that we pitched to the Reader because as freelancers, we had been working with the Reader. So when we started the tribe, we were like, why end this relationship? And so that gives us a way to reshape the narrative, not only through our platform, but now we get to have a voice with the Reader. I get to have conversations mm-hmm. with Mr. Eisendraff all the time. And I wouldn't have that access otherwise. So it's like we get to get some revenue by partnerships, but also we also get to kind of have a voice and use other platforms to get out our message as well.
So Melena Tuss is asking a question that I think will resonate with a lot of us, which is there's a sense of the news media in Chicago as being relentlessly negative. Why are 80%, her question is, why is it that 80% of the time the stories are negative stories? It's a battle to get positive stories in the newspaper. So, I mean, I think Morgan talked a little bit about what
right.
you're trying to do to counter that, but let me let Bruce respond to that.
Sure.
Why does it seem like the coverage is so negative about our city?
I think there's a more intense reaction to negative stories. I don't think that there's an imbalance in what we do. In fact, we make a real effort, I think, to tell stories about you know, life. Amy Carr is one of the editors, key editors here. Lori Rackle, one of the best writers that we've got. They want to tell you about what, you know, how do you get around the city? Where do you get around the state? Where do you want to go? There's a lot of coverage like that. It does get a good audience. It doesn't anger people. And so I think there's a little bit of a sense that there's a sense that there's more negativity than there really is.
Morgan.
Yeah, I'd just like to add that we feel as if the focus on negative coverage is about driving traffic to the page, but there's been a neglect in terms of thinking about community impacts, because you can easily cover gun violence in a way that brings about some sort of solution or hopefulness. But I think in that period of 2012 through 2016, being a Black millennial and being from Chicago, it's almost traumatic to watch and read the news. So what is that doing to your audience? You're alienating your audience, because there's so much as a Black, there's only so much that I can take as a consumer, and then you want me to pay for it. How can I pay to read and watch these gruesome images of people who look like me on the worst days of their lives? And so we really started to think about how can the tribe help repair this relationship between the media and the community? Because even as freelancers, when we would go out and say, hey, I want to cover a story about Douglas Park, and Black people would be telling us, don't put me on the news, don't write my name down. So when we saw that type of reaction, we thought, wow, there's work to be done in terms of repairing that relationship. So it goes deeper than just a headline. It has to be about community engagement. Yeah.
And then the same person had a follow-up question, which was a little bit of a shift to thinking about online access as it relates to concerns about privacy and data security and so on. Is that something that preoccupies any of you on the panel, or concerns any of you on the panel at this point?
Not data security. The more I learn about what's happening in the world of data, the more creepy and amazing I think it is, what all of us have revealed about ourselves, whether we know it or not. I mean, we have products for advertisers that follow people around. It's kind of creepy, but it works very well. And I just think generally that, not data security, but the whole world of data and how much everybody knows about everybody is something we all should take a breath and think about.
Yeah, I don't know why I get so many ads for shoes all the time. I just don't get it. I'd like to close just to talk a little bit about fake news and the concerns that people have about the legitimacy of the information that they're getting. And I doubt that's true for the Tribune and Sun-Times at this point, but on some level it must affect you. And then in a more startup environment, you know, you must get some folded arms, like, okay, where is this coming from, and how can I believe this story? I think it's got to be a problem, though, for everybody who's a consumer, and so it eventually is going to be a problem for the producers, I would think.
Bettelman does some really interesting work on sort of a trust barometer, and it shows that trust in institutions, including the media, has fallen greatly. Trust in government, trust in business, we're all up against it from that standpoint. I do think, as you see, as people are learning more about what they can't trust, I mean, you can go on social media and, man, you find wild things that just aren't true. So then it falls to us to make sure that people differentiate. First of all, we got to be ultra-transparent, I think, on what we're writing, who's writing it, what the sources are. Again, if you can put data out to show, here are the sources that we used on a story, that helps to build trust. That's one of the great things about having a digital platform that you couldn't have in print. We can do all that. This is a great opportunity for media to build trust and differentiate themselves.
So, Seamus, how often can you get the story wrong before people start tuning you out? You know, like if you're relying on folks
Zero.
On the ground?
Zero. I mean, one time can screw it up for forever. Does it happen? Of course it does. And to Bruce's point, you got to be transparent about it, acknowledge where the breakdown was, what was wrong, and what was right. But I mean, that's obviously the goal is to be right all the time. And it's harder and harder the faster and faster that you put the news out there. You want to be the first person to send out the news alert. You want to be the first person to put it on Facebook or Twitter. So you got to, you know, that's why it takes, you know, real reporters and real editors and real sources to make sure what you're doing is right, because, yeah, in this day and age, you can erode your credibility in a hurry.
Helen, the fake news moniker is most often a political one, a partisan one, rather than a fact one. And so we talked about, you know, journalists, and the Edelman Barometer says, you know, nobody trusts the media, but actually journalists are ranking pretty high for it, you know, and that people want to know that there are honest folks out there trying to get the stories, trying to run down the facts and tell them. Our goal is to shrink the realm of politics back to where it belongs so that there's space for people to have a dialogue about facts. And because I really don't think the fake news claim is really about journalists making fact mistakes anymore.
I can say that fake news, the tribe was founded right after Trump's inauguration, so it was right in the midst of fake news, and it did create some barriers for us because it's very difficult for us to get verified. And we can't get a Wikipedia page. We have to jump through a million hoops, even though many people have written about the tribe and kind of verified us in the media community.
We do have a Wikipedia page that was completely taken over by the NRA, so I'm not sure, pluses and minuses to Wikipedia.
But I think it was very important for us to kind of actually not brand ourselves as news and to brand ourselves more as a community, yeah. So that we didn't have to be called fake news because it's just like we are all the tribe.
Yeah. You know? Well, I want to thank the four of you for the unbelievably challenging and wonderful work that each of you does somewhere along the spectrum of news organizations. I think our city would be so much worse off if all four of you, as well as the rest of the news media in Chicago, weren't vital and alive. So thank you very much for the work you do and for being here.
Thank you, Alan.
Thank you, Alan.